I have Dick Smith with me, and he has written a book called Ball's Pyramid, 50 Years of Exploration, and also called Climbing the World's Tallest Sea Stack. Welcome, Dick.
Great to be talking to you, Tony.
Thank you. Look, tell me why writing this book was important to you.
I think it was really important because of the tremendous change that's taken in the allowable risk-taking for young people. The book is about this extraordinary world's highest sea stack, which comes straight out of the ocean about 15 miles to the south of Lord Howe Island, which is in the ocean to the east of Sydney. And I went out as a 20-year-old Boy Scout, which is just over 50 years ago, and attempted to climb it. I failed to get to the top, but I then went back in 1980 and got to the top, and the book explains it. But the incredibly sad thing was that in those days, I just organised the scouts with a sponsor, and we sailed a yacht out to the stack, and we swam aboard. We had to grab hold of a ledge as the waves washed us against the rock, because there's no beaches or anything, no landing areas. And that was all allowed. The scouts allowed it. There was no regulations against it. After I climbed it in 1980, the bureaucrats came in. And half the book is this fascinating story, not only about the other climbers, and some of the world's best climbers have been to the top in just about every way you could go, but also how the bureaucrats then got in to ban people from climbing the Ball's Pyramid. And now it is banned. You're just simply illegal. It's a huge fine to even land on the pyramid. But fortunately, the book covers that just as I was finishing the book, a couple of young adventurers sailed out from Sydney and did what we did 50 years ago and illegally climbed to the top of the pyramid and told me their story. And there's even a photograph in the book of their illegal climb, and they haven't been fined because no one knows who they are.
Right. Look, it's, and therefore Ball's Pyramid, obviously it has a piece of Australia's history. It was known from...
It was discovered just after the First Fleet. The First Fleet came into Sydney Harbour in 1788, if I remember correctly. I think Captain Arthur Phillip put the flag up on January the 26th, was it?
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, and a couple of days later, they sent one of the ships, one of the First Fleet ships, to Norfolk Island to set up another colony there, but they wanted to look at the Norfolk Island pines for ship's masts. And on the way there or back, or I think it was both ways, they sighted Lord Howe Island and Ball's Pyramid. Mm-hmm. And so it's been famous since virtually the first days of Australia. And Lord Howe Island, which to me is the most wonderful place in the world, and I've been to 200 countries so far, but Ball's Pyramid is the most spectacular place I've ever seen. And I'd recommend, even if you don't buy this fantastic book, that you go out to Lord Howe Island, and you can get a little charter boat down around the pyramid. And remember, if you look, say, in Sydney at our television towers, Ball's Pyramid is three times those towers on top of each other. It's 1.5 times the height of the Empire State Building, but it's straight out of the ocean, vertically.
Mm.
And it is the most spectacular thing you could ever imagine.
How deep does it go under the ocean?
It goes, it's the side of a volcano. The interesting thing was they thought Lord Howe and Ball's Pyramid was the same volcano. But now that they've done some very good ocean exploration, and we've showed this in the book, it shows that it's a separate volcano. Mm-hmm. And so Ball's Pyramid is the remnants of the rim of a separate volcano, and Lord Howe Island with Mount Garran and Mount Lidgeberg is the other separate crater of a separate volcano.
So does it go deep under, or is it just...
Yes, it goes. It's the channel between Ball's Pyramid and Lord Howe Island is hundreds and hundreds of metres deep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... But Ball's Pyramid is the top of this mountain range because it's many kilometres deep between Sydney and Ball's Pyramid, and then it drops the ocean to many kilometres again to New Zealand. But there's this extraordinary Lord Howe Island rise which comes down, and it's just about completely hidden except for Elizabeth Reef, Middleton Reef, Lord Howe Island and Ball's Pyramid.
I think you said in the book that there was a series of 8 volcanoes together, something like that.
That's right, yes, and I can't remember all the details there, but... I mean, the fascinating thing about the book is it tells the history of, in effect, Ball's Pyramid, how it was created.
Mm-hmm.
Then it has the wonderful story of the phasmid, mm-hmm. the land lobster. The phasmid was this extraordinary little looked like a very large praying mantis that existed on Lord Howe Island until the early 1900s, when a ship was wrecked and the rats got off the ship and ate all the phasmids. But a number of, when we were on our very first expedition in 1964, we took a photograph of a dead phasmid. So we knew that they had been alive on Ball's Pyramid. And after that stage, some naturalists went back and found the phasmid there. And the phasmid is now being bred in the Melbourne Zoo in the thousands, of course, but that's been one of the reasons that they've banned climbing on the pyramid because of this endangered phasmid. By the way, it's mainly banned because bureaucrats love, as the book quotes, people who sit in offices love to stop people from doing things. And that really runs right through the whole book. In fact, the most amazing thing is the Lord Howe Island Act at the moment. I'll just read this from my introduction. It actually says, wait for this, even today, section 72 of the Lord Howe Island regulation administered by the board reads, a person must not engage in any activity or recreational pursuit in the preserve that involves risking the safety of the person or the safety of other persons. Now, riding a bike risks safety. They go scuba diving there. They walk up the tracks. But it's the island of bureaucracy, Lord Howe Island, and they have rules that you couldn't believe. And if a young person on Lord Howe Island who's born there decides to go off the track to the goat house, he could be fined. And he or she is not allowed to climb Mount Gower up the very good track unless they take a licensed guide and pay $60 or whatever it is to be part of the group. So it just shows, and the book really covers this well, how you can take the spirit of adventure away from people. And my spirit of adventure that I learned at Ball's Pyramid, 4 years later, I started Dick Smith Electronics, which has been in the news recently, but over 48 years has employed tens of thousands of Australians and made lots of money for lots of people and given good service. And I'm hoping it will be saved in some way. We don't know that. But starting that business came because of the risk-taking I learned on Ball's Pyramid. And I've mentioned in the book that if you stop responsible risk-taking by young people, you end up with them taking ice or going to ISIS in the Middle East to try and get adventure. Because you can't take that spirit of adventure out of people. You might think you can, but you can't.
So when you, just going back to the phasmid, when the first person saw one, did they actually know that it was a dead phasmid and that that was an extinct? So how did that come about?
I'll tell you what happened. It's covered in the book. Dave Roots took the photograph. He was one of our expedition members of our 1964 Rover Scout sailing trip out to the pyramid when we only got two-thirds of the way up. And I think it was the next year he was showing the slides at the Australian Museum. I think it might have been to Harold Cogger. And he said, oh, that slide you've just shown me, that's the extinct phasmid. And Dave said, well, it wasn't extinct, you know, 12 months ago because we took this photograph of a recently dead one. And that's what gave the excitement. But it was then over 20 years before they were found living on the pyramid.
Right, okay.
And in fact, when I did my climb in 1980, I took two scientists to the pyramid and landed them there to look for the phasmid, but they didn't find any. But fortunately, 10 years or so later, they were found.
So there's a lot of birds on the sea stack.
Yep.
Are they were they feeding off the phasmid, or is the phasmid operating separately to the birds?
Yeah, they're absolutely separately. All of the birds, as far as I know, are seabirds, and so they get their food from the sea. The bird life is just fantastic. And you can't climb, unless you're a really good climber, maybe climb it in a day. Normally you have to camp, and you're camping on a vertical sea stack. The ledge that I slept on was 18 inches wide, 450 millimetres wide. And I had to bolt myself on. I put a bolt in a rope around so I didn't roll off. But all night, beautiful birds were landing on me in my sleeping bag because they would come in to roost on this ledge that they'd been roosting on for the last couple of million years. And here was a human being lying there. But the climbers have no measurable effect on the bird life. Of course, from time to time, you get these extraordinary storms that come through and wipe out a tremendous amount of the birds, especially if it's in a breeding season. But the birds are tame, and you can lift them off a ledge and climb past them and sit them back on the ledge again. They just look at you. They're just the most lovely bird life.
Wow. So you've obviously done a lot of travelling. And wherever you go around the world, be it man-made or natural wonders that are out there, have a certain energy about them.
Yep.
Machu Picchu, Taj Mahal, the Iguazu Falls.
Yep.
The sea stack, Ball's Pyramid, how does that rank? How does that...
It's one of the most emotive ones. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. My favourite place in the world is really Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there many times. It's just magnificent. It's the last great wilderness, even though it's now become the continent of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
But Lord Howe, to go there, especially when we sailed up in this little tiny boat, and I'm a 20-year-old Boy Scout, and this little boat's 50 feet long, and we've come from Sydney, it's taken 3 days, we've been seasick for the first couple of days, finally got over that. And we sail up to this monstrous sea stack, 1.5 times the height of the Empire State Building. And it is just one of the most emotive things I've ever seen in all my life. And I must admit, even now, I quite often fly around it. When I was out at Christmas time with my family at Lord Howe Island, so I took my plane down and flew around the pyramid, and it looks completely unclimbable. I know that I've been to the top, so I've climbed every inch of it, and I think it's been climbed by about 20 people now.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks unclimbable, but it is climbable. And if it was situated in the Blue Mountains, it would be climbed, probably be made illegal by now, but if it was allowed, it would be climbed every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's in such a remote location in the Tasman Sea, which is a very rough ocean, there's sharks. When you swim aboard, when you're climbing, you're looking down, you can see the sharks cruising around the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And that's where you've swum ashore and grabbed hold of a ledge to lever yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's a very emotive place. It combined with Lord Howe Island, probably one of the best places I've been.
So then how do we... I mean, obviously, is the bureaucracy coming from Lord Howe Island only, or is it coming from Australia wide?
No, it's coming mainly... I don't think it's coming from Lord Howe. It's coming from the bureaucrats within the National Parks Organisation within Sydney. And bureaucracies are like that. You know, how can we control, how can we stop someone from doing something? And for example, you can't climb the Three Sisters anymore, one of the best rock climbs in Australia. That's banned.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it's for Aboriginal reasons, but I understand a bureaucrat said to the Aboriginal people, oh, did you climb that? And they said, no. Oh, is it sacred? Oh, yes, it's sacred. And so that was the excuse to ban climbing.
Mm-hmm.
The Aboriginal people didn't climb it because they didn't have the technology, which are the ropes and the pitons and the things that we use these days, cams, which belay you. They didn't have, they were Stone Age people.
Yeah.
They didn't have the steel work that you would need to do that. And also they spent most of their time hunter and gathering. They weren't, didn't have days of recreation to climb things. It wasn't within their culture at the time. But that's been banned. I cover in the book and show a photograph of me on the top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, because in the night in the 60s, everyone used to climb the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the authorities knew this but took a blind eye to it because we weren't hurting anyone. But nowadays, if you tried to climb the bridge, you'd be charged as a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be banned, or you have to pay a fortune and be tied onto the bridge as you climb there, sort of thing.
Yeah. So do you think we'll end up eventually with some sort of Sydney Harbour Bridge commercial operation taking you through to Ball's Pyramid
I don't know. I think I have a feeling there's going to be a change because this book has been put out. I'm already finding, I was at Lord Howe Island at Christmas time, and they're already talking about allowing climbers who will go and be able to look for phasmids at different heights on the pyramid. Well, I don't mind. And regulated climbing of the pyramid should be allowed. There'd only be probably one group a year who'd ever want to go there.
Mm.
And they're normally going to be very skilled. Lord Howe Island, of all the climbs on the pyramid, we've never had a fatality or even a serious injury.
Mm.
No one has ever had to be rescued, even though I'm looking at the photograph now in the book of me standing on the top of the pyramid with Lord Howe Island in the background and the big mountain is Mount Gower. And that's where they have guided tours. And twice I've had to send helicopters from Nowra all the way to Lord Howe Island to rescue people off that track.
Right.
And this is the tourists. And so generally speaking, the tourists are at greater risk on Lord Howe Island than skilled climbers are on Bull's Pyramid.
So is it still, obviously it sounds like it's still worth visiting Lord Howe. I mean, you went there for your honeymoon. My parents went there for theirs.
It's a wonderful place. Yeah.
But to get out to the sea stack as well as part of that.
If you could do that, and it's quite easy. Normally just ask for a smooth day and the ocean and the boats will take you down. I think it probably costs $40 or something, and they'll take you down to the pyramid. It's about 2 hours and to get down there, and they cruise around it. So my suggestion, first of all, you're not a real Australian until you've gone to Lord Howe and stayed at Lord Howe. It's so magnificent. And secondly, to go down and have a look at Ball's Pyramid is just quite fantastic, and I'd recommend it to anyone.
And do you think this is going to... How does Ball's Pyramid fit in the... when you've travelled around the world in terms of the rest of the world? They know the Opera House.
Yes.
They know Uluru.
Yes.
They know Kakadu.
You know, it's amazing that the climbers all know of Ball's Pyramid and know that it's banned. It's very famous because it's the world's tallest sea stack.
Mm-hmm.
So the world's tallest mountain is Mount Everest. But this is the world's tallest sea stack. In fact, there is nothing like it. You see those photographs of Thailand, and they show the area near Phuket, which has these little tiny sea stacks of probably 200 or 300 feet high.
Yep.
Well, this is 5-6 times the height. Mm-hmm. It is so spectacular, and it's in a remote ocean location. Mm-hmm. It's not close to the coast. So it is something that, look, people who have seen it have said to me, wow, that's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my whole life.
Yeah.
And not many people will be able to climb it, but any person can get on a boat and cruise around the pyramid and have a look at it and be affected by the fact that it could still be there. It's very narrow. It's probably about 2 kilometres long, but at one stage it's only a couple of, not even 100 metres thick. And in fact, one of the top ridges, I was flying there a couple of weeks ago, there's holes been blown right through by the wind, and you can see holes through the top of the pyramid because it's very thin. It's just a most emotive rock covered in growth and, of course, bird life, plus the Lord Howe Island phasmid, the very rare insect, is there as well.
So do you think that Tourism New South Wales could be doing a far better job in terms of promoting Lord Howe, and that as a destination, you come to Australia, you do the Barrier Reef, you do Kakadu, you do Uluru, you do the Big Sea.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there's no doubt they... One of the problems, of course, is that Lord Howe is very sensible. They decided about 30 years ago to limit the number of tourists to 400 tourist beds. And it's the wisest thing. So Lord Howe is mainly booked out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter happens to own a lodge there called Capella Lodge. And it's basically booked out. It's only 9 rooms. Mm. And imagine that I went and climbed Ball's Pyramid. 4 years later, I went back with my young wife, Pip, who's still my wife today. And she was 19, so I would have been 24. And we spent our honeymoon on Lord Howe Island. And now, 40 years later, we're back there with our kids who own a lodge and our grandkids and staying on Lord Howe, where we spent so much time.
Mm.
But yes, the tourism authority could help. It's the most expensive air service in the world. It costs probably as much to go to Lord Howe as it does to go to Fiji or Bali. But I can tell you Lord Howe is about 10 times better.
Mm-hmm.
If you were Disney and you said, look, we have to design this incredible island, what do we need? You'd say, oh, well, you need some mountains. You need a barrier reef, coral reef. You need some surfing beaches. You need some rainforest. You need some sand hills. You need fish that you can just hand feed. You need the most incredible bird life that you could ever see anywhere in the world. Oh, and if you put all those things together, that's Lord Howe Island.
Mm.
And the mutton birds, or the shearwaters, which you see there, fly every year. If you go there at Christmas time, they've just arrived from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And they nest there, and you're walking right amongst them because it's such a wonderful place, Lord Howe Island. And only 400 tourist beds. Mostly the planes tended to be booked out. And my suggestion for people is go in wintertime. I love it in winter. And you've got more chance of staying there.
So this book that you've written, it seemed like in the beginning, when I got my copy.
Yep.
That was almost like a memento for anyone that had been involved in your expeditions. But is it more, and is it going to be more for a reader and somebody who won't potentially get to go there? What was your intention around
the book? The original one was the original reason for the book is to put political pressure on to get the regulations changed that stop young people from going on the Spirit of Adventure. And I now have to send one of the books to the Premier with a letter and asking him to read certain bits of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to campaign with the book with the story that if you take the Spirit of Adventure away from young Australians, you're going to destroy Australia as we know it today.
Mm.
So that was the reason for the book. And in fact, I originally printed 120 copies, and it was just to do that. But very quickly, people read it. And it is a very good history of the climbs. It's a ripping good yarn because I've used the other climbers' text when they've climbed the pyramid, and some of it's incredibly exciting.
Mm-hmm.
They're better writers than me. And it's a wonderful story because it starts off with Rick Higgins and Dave Roots, who just flew out in the flying boat and were only taken down for a few hours at a time. And then it ends up at the very end of the book with this young climbers who sailed out and got to the top illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And then covers the court cases we had, the frustration of getting bureaucrats to agree that they would allow climbing on the pyramid and then to change their mind. And there's a message, I think, in the book that if you're not careful, our forefathers went off and fought for freedoms, that we have freedom to do certain things. But then if you allow bureaucrats just to take the freedom away without any good reasoning, that's what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping the book is going to, more and more people are going to read it, and more people will be saying to their politicians, look, this is ridiculous to stop climbing the world's tallest sea stack. We can bring people from overseas. Some of the top climbers in the world want to come. They'll do a major documentary on Lord Howe Island and the pyramid, which will be shown National Geographic Channel around the world. No, they can't do that because they're not allowed to land on the pyramid.
Mm.
So the bureaucrats who are involved really just don't get it. Now, having said that, Lord Howe is full a lot of the time. There are very many times in winter when there's plenty of space in the lodges there that you could stay. And I'd rather than put pressure on Lord Howe Island to go to high rise, like, say, Hamilton Island,
mm-hmm.
I'd hate to see that happen. I'd love to see quality, not quantity, and just improve the quality of the accommodation but still limit the number of people going there.
So a bit like Heron Island with the conservation.
A bit like Heron Island, but of course Heron is almost completely covered by people because it's so tiny.
Mm.
But yes, that's a good example. It has a research station there.
Yeah.
Lord Howe it's like Heron Island combined with Dunk Island, combined with Lizard Island, combined with Galapagos.
Yeah.
It is the most extraordinary place in the world. Mm. And I'm amazed that I can't believe, because I've been there, I'd say 50 times in the last 50 years, that people say to me, I've never been to Lord Howe, I'd like to go there. And they've been around the world to lots of places, but never been to Lord Howe.
It's going to be an interesting feedback from readers when they buy your book.
Yep.
Only 2,000 copies have been printed. Absolutely. So it is limited.
It's going to be very rare.
It'll be rare. It's a collectible.
Yep.
It's a part of Australian history. So,
and you've got it on a special price too, I know.
We do. As we always do. And really encourage, I've had the chance to go through it. I haven't read it word for word, unfortunately, as yet. But I've read a lot of it, and it's a good read. It's inspiring. I think one of the things as an entrepreneur myself, Dick, of course, is an Australian icon and is known for his entrepreneurship. I think we all come from a background of not agreeing to rules, and that rules are there to be broken or to
yes.
to redefine other people's thinking. And let's hope that this artifact, this book, does in fact change the way that bureaucrats consider what is soon to be a spotlight on a new Australian, or not new, but an Australian iconic
yeah. And Tony, just very quickly, it tells the story of starting Dick Smith Electronics, because the most amazing thing is it was my scoutmaster, Tony Balthazar, who loaned us the money to charter the boat, and he then loaned me the money to start Dick Smith Electronics, because he was a radio ham. And I'm just looking at the picture here in the book of the first shop, and those letters that say Dick Smith Electronics, they were boat registration letters. I couldn't afford the cost of a sign writer, so I found you could buy boat registration letters and stick them on the sign yourself to save money.
Not only that, for anyone that lives in the Lower North Shore, which I do, and have gone to the Big Bear
shopping centre,
and when you park downstairs, I did not know, but it was great to read that that is in fact where Dick Smith Electronics started, in the car park of the Big Bear shopping centre. So if you're ever going to shop at Coles or go to the medical centre or go to the Oaks, you can just kind of
see where the
stop
original
for a moment
Dick Smith shop was,
where he paid $15 per week rent. That was actually an enjoyable little
read
for me. It was indeed,
Well, the book covers lots of interesting things like that, and I think that's where people are going to find it fascinating, that it's not just a climbing book. Climbing books would be boring to other than climbing people. This is a book of adventure.
And anyone, I think if anyone's read or seen the Australian Geographic magazine, this is like buying one of those magazines, reading an article, and it's on steroids. It's like literally a fully blown, great article about Australia and about our geography.
One of the reasons, it's got some similarities with Australian Geographic is that the person who helped me write it was Howard Whalen, the editor of Australian Geographic, the original editor, and the art direction and art layout was done by Tony Gordon, who was the original art layout man, art director from Australian Geographic. So that's why there's some similarities with the quality.
Look, as you can imagine, Dick has spared no expense in producing a quality product. Booktopia highly recommends it, and we look forward to hearing your interpretation and enjoyment of buying this book. Thank you, Dick, for your time and all the success in the future.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.